This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. It's not easy to talk about race in this country, and it's probably even harder to talk about class, but not for our guest, sociologist Annette Leroux. She wanted to find out how class can affect a parent's style of child rearing. So back in the 90s, she and her research assistant spent time watching 12 families from different socioeconomic educational backgrounds to see how parents interacted with their elementary school-aged children. While all the families loved their children and wanted the best for them, they expressed it differently. Leroux wrote about it in her book, Unequal Childhoods, and she followed up with the families about a decade later. Her findings are still provocative and touch on important policy and personal issues, and that's why she joins us once again on Radio Times. She's now the Stanley I. Scheer Professor of Social Sciences and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, and she is the president of the American Sociological Association. And Annette Leroux, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
We're probably going to go over some of the things that you and I went over when your book first came out, but again, as I said, I think your findings are still provocative. How do you convince families to, in a sense, allow you and your assistants to spend so much family time with them?
Well, we began by visiting children in school, and then we did an individual interview with first the mother and then the father, if the father was present. And we would go, we would visit, we'd send a handwritten thank you note, we'd bring a pie. And so they would get to know us through this call the night before. And so we did ask 19 families to get 12, and some did decline. But we did pay them. If I was doing it today, I would have offered an honorarium of $1,000. So there was an economic incentive. But some of the families who were poor, it was 1 month's income, did decline. And some of the families were sort of resistant at first. We didn't just ask families who we thought would agree. We asked a range of families.
And what was the pitch? I mean, in a sense, what were you saying to them that you would be doing?
I said that I thought that it's hard work to raise children, and we wanted to understand the reality of what it was like to get the children through the day from families from different walks of life, and that often on TV there's an overly romantic view of family, and we wanted to really understand how much work it was for parents to get children through the day.
I'm trying to imagine if you or one of your assistants, you know, moved into my house or spent time with my family. I don't know if I would have said yes, and I also wonder whether we would have all been on our best or better behavior if we knew we had a researcher there.
Well, we noticed that yelling went up and cursing went up on the third day and again on the 10th day. And we usually went for about 2 or 3 hours. We tried to go every day for about 3 weeks, but it varied. We tried to go with families to get a haircut, to go to the park, to different activities. And we also, the children who were 10 at the time, they would tell us afterwards. We did exit interviews. They said, my mom talked more, the house was cleaner. So they said there were ways, but mostly they said that they were just like themselves.
And what were you looking for?
We were interested in how parents help children get through the day. We were interested particularly in how they negotiated with schools or with doctors. And one of the big surprises was how much difference there was in language, that middle-class parents who had a college degree and often had a professional job simply talked more in the home than blue-collar families or poor families. And the blue-collar and poor families loved their children very much. It was just a comfortable silence. But the amount of speech in the middle-class families, so middle-class parents asked questions, answered questions with questions, while the working-class parents gave directives.
You mean literally just more words were spoken in a middle-class family?
Many, many more words. And so you had a lot of whining, and you had a lot of middle-class kids bartering with their parents and negotiating. I don't want to eat that now. Why do I have to eat that now? Why are you making me do this? So often things became extended conversation, just little things like whether or not people were going to have a snack right then.
You came to a conclusion, and it is tricky to talk about class because you could think about class in just in terms of how much money people make or maybe where they live. You seem to think about class in terms of education.
That's correct, because if somebody loses his or her job, the question is what kind of job can they get next? And if you have an income of $80,000, you're a salesman, but you don't have a college degree, the kinds of jobs you can apply for are very restricted. Mm-hmm. And so I look particularly at education, and there's other research when people are upwardly mobile, when they're their mothers are high school dropouts or high school graduates, and then they go on to get a college degree, it turns out to change the way that they parent their children. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to use language, they're less likely to use corporal punishment, and they're more likely to be involved in homework in different ways. So yes, we looked at African American and white families, and we looked at it mostly, they had to have a college degree and a job where they had some autonomy to be middle class.
You said one of the conclusions, just to underscore, that the parents, they love their children, they just seem to express it differently, but that middle-class parents, and we should say this is obviously a very small sample, mm-hmm. but they saw their kids as, quote, projects.
They did.
Something to be, as you said, cultivated.
Yes, it's a gardening analogy.
I can relate.
And so the idea is that parents saw their children, they would say, he or she can do anything he or she wants. And so they said, I don't want him to be Mozart, but I want him to be exposed to music. And so even by the time children were 8, they were in baseball and ballet and soccer and church. And I would have given my right arm for a middle-class child who had no organized activities, none. And I really couldn't find any. And they say, oh, we don't do much. We don't do traveling soccer. Or the people who do rugby, the people who do ice hockey, they're crazy. They go, but everybody, all the middle-class families did something.
But the idea is that all these activities, this was good for my child. I'm going to be involved in their life. I'm going to sort of help them learn some of the lessons of life through all these activities.
That's right. And parents believed that they were helpful, and it was hard, like, who could be against brownies? There wasn't much of a counter-narrative, though sometimes now doctors say, don't have your child be too busy, and people schedule unscheduled time. And people have told me that they've overheard people in the park yelling at their kid, hurry up, Timmy, you're going to be late for your unscheduled time.
No.
You know? That's true, yeah.
It's a
true quote, yeah. And so people are racing. But it did make middle-class families very busy. Of course, most mothers work outside the home. Many work full-time. And if you have multiple kids, sometimes the kids take 8 to 10 hours per child for the activities, and the parents had work. Sometimes parents had travel schedules. So there was a frenetic pace of family life, and if the fireplace was the center of the 19th century, the calendar was really the center of these homes.
Sort of managing everyone's schedules and comings and goings, and when you throw in a meal, I guess, on top of that.
That's right, and like even birthday parties are very elaborate now, and if everyone could go to a birthday party, it was very common for there to be 8 to 10 activities in a spring weekend for a family with 3 children at least, and then there are rainouts and birthday parties and performances.
I'm exhausted.
So people were very tired, and even though the kids were exactly the same age, if the working class kids had a spring concert, they looked younger. They were smiling, they were waving, they were like, hi, Mom, while the middle class kids, when they were 10, looked bored. It was just one more thing.
Well, interesting. And then again, talking about class here and the more working class kids, as you say, sort of a less hands-on approach to parenting, I guess you use that gardening analogy more. Natural garden, yes?
Natural growth. And, I mean, to be sure, parents were using very scarce resources to pay the rent, to get food on the table, to pay for the heat. Every dollar counted. There was tremendous economic strain. So to get children through the day was really an accomplishment. But parents had this notion that kids could play outside. And so the working class kids had childhoods, even today, that were very similar to the ones that some of the middle-class parents had when they were young, but they no longer were having. So the kids would just run around outside, they'd watch TV, they would play with their cousins. If they had organized activities, it was just one. It was child-initiated, not parent-initiated. And the kids had much more of a child culture where they would play together with their friends.
We also describe, I guess, if the calendar was the hearth of the middle-class family, for the working-class family, it was maybe the TV. Where there was a lot of family time together in front of the TV.
That's right. I would say it was the extended family. It was their cousins, their aunts, their uncles, who often lived within the same area, who they saw all the time, sometimes were like brothers and sisters. And there were often many family events, weddings, christenings, birthday parties that were just very important part of family life. But the TV was always on, and there was always TV going on, and it was an important part of daily life, too.
Would you say one of these styles is better than another? Can we say that?
I think they both have advantages and they both have drawbacks. And you see the middle-class kids, they are treated as if they are very special from the time that they're young, from the time they're 3 or 4 years old. Their opinion counts, so we would go with them to the doctor's office, and the child would say something, and the middle-class parents would pay attention, the doctor would pay attention. And they would allow the child to weigh in. While we would go to the working class family to the doctor, and one of the girls said, I have a birthmark. And her mother was like, hush. It was like the doctor's time was valuable, and they were trying not to intervene. And so you do see middle class kids have a sense of entitlement, like that they think the world should be organized around their preferences. You see this in grade protests in Ivy League schools. You see this in this increasing emphasis on my individual preferences. And so I think that that is, in a sense, that the adults should cater to them and their ideals. And I do think you see that more in middle-class families than working-class families.
Because it's true, right? I mean, the world does cater to their desires.
That's right. But then when you reach adulthood, the world isn't always organized around your preferences. And there's some hints in the literature that the transition to adulthood is more difficult for some of the middle-class kids. Because the working-class kids, they've been exposed to limits and difficulty already, and they're grown. They define themselves as grown, and their parents define themselves as grown when they were 18. While for middle-class parents, the kids, it was more of a project as they went into their 20s and even 30s.
As opposed to sort of raising yourself up to some degree?
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of the working-class parents, they really wanted their kids to graduate from high school, and they ended up dropping out. But the working-class parents said, there's nothing I can do. It's up to him. And while the middle-class parents were trying to sort of still micromanage their child's lives in ways that were either helpful or not helpful, and you see that also in university campuses, with cell phones and email and Twitter, there's just more dependence of young adults on their parents, it appears, than there was 3 or 4 decades ago.
You also observed more, more overt hostility in middle-class families.
Yes, the sibling relationships were different. And I do think I interviewed them again when they were when they were 20, and they did report things had gotten better.
Right.
But in the working class families, it's not that everything was all cozy, but there was a sense of solidarity there, that they were all together, and particularly at school they were all together. Well, the sibling arguments in middle class families were very bitter and hostile, and there would be open like when we were watching one white middle class girl and her brother, she was listening to music, her brother came in and started playing piano, and she said, "I hate him," and the mother said, "I know."
Meaning, I know.
That was just the way that family worked, that sometimes kids were frustrated with their brothers and the parents didn't necessarily like it. Or another one, we were going on a car trip with an African-American family, and the two girls were in the back, and at one point one of the sisters had her other sister and was like pounding her against the window, and the parents were like, "Oh my God, we should have separated them. I should have sat in the back." But they didn't necessarily like it, but it was just part of the way the family worked. While you just really didn't see that kind of hostility in the working class families.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about families and class, an issue that isn't always easy to talk about. Our guest is Annette Leroux, and she's the Stanley I. Scheer Professor of Social Sciences and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Wrote a book a number of years ago called Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family Life. A couple of years ago, there was a second edition with a follow-up study, and we're talking about how families work, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Burdami Volvo in Huntington Valley supports WHYY and offers a variety of new and pre-owned models, featuring two new 2013 Volvo S80s available for delivery. Full inventory at burdamivolvo.com, 215-947-6363.
Abington Health supports WHYY. Few weapons are as powerful in the fight against colorectal cancer as early diagnosis. Colorectal cancer usually has no symptoms. To aid in the goal of early detection, colonoscopy screenings are recommended starting at age 50, or sooner if there is a strong family history. If you are diagnosed with cancer, Abington Health has many treatment options. Scheduling information is available by calling 215-481-MEDI.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, Jane Goodall is known for studying chimps, but the roots of her work are in her love of trees.
To me, trees are living beings. They have their own personalities. I'm not being scientific here. I'm just talking about the way it feels.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Bryn Athyn College, quality liberal arts in a spiritual setting since 1877. Details at 267-728-4218 or brynathyn.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just joining us, our guest is sociologist Annette Leroux. We're talking about a study that she did a number of years ago, but it still lives on in many ways. She and her research assistants studied and followed the lives of 12 families who were upper middle class, they were working class, poor, they had children in elementary school, and she found very different styles of parenting. She wrote about it in a book called Unequal Childhoods with a follow-up study in the second edition, and she is sharing some of these findings with us. She's currently studying how parents choose to buy a house and where to live. We want to hear from you. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You did do a follow-up. I guess the children were, what, 10, in their late teens by the time you caught up with them?
They were about 19 or 20 when I did the follow-up, and now they're 30.
And now they're 30.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what did you find at 19 or 20?
There were really no surprises. There were 88 children in the original study, and there were 12 that I followed around. But for the most part, the middle-class kids went to college, often elite colleges. And for the most part, the working-class kids and the poor kids were working and did not go to college or maybe had a semester or half a semester at community college and were employed in blue-collar jobs.
And is it because of their childhoods they were not prepared for the world of work? Can we say that?
Well, the parents wanted them to go to college, the working class and poor families, but college is expensive. You need, it turns out, a lot of informal knowledge to apply to college. There was one young woman who applied to a number of colleges, but her SAT scores were, at the time on the 1600, they were only 800, which was not that uncommon for an inner city child. And then she applied to schools where the SATs that they were accepted were several hundred points above. Mm-hmm. Now, if she had been my daughter, I could have probably helped her apply to a school. But you needed the fit. You need to know where to apply. And so she applied to inappropriate schools, and she was rejected everywhere.
We read more recently, maybe this is because of the recession or also maybe other just structures that are built into our economy, which is that we're not a particularly mobile society these days.
That's right. There are some people who say it's about 4% of children who start out with a high school, whose parents have a high school degree, who end up with a professional degree.
Right.
And in another study with Heather Curl and Tina Wu, I've been doing interviews with people who are upwardly mobile, whose parents have a high school degree and have an MD or a JD. And it's interesting. It's almost always a teacher who helped them.
Is that right?
That's right. A teacher in elementary school or middle school who helped them, who introduced them to a counselor, and who told them to go to college.
But is it just, it's just so hard. I mean, the way our society is structured, where people live, the kinds of schools that are there, the kinds of opportunities, that we've just sort of baked in barriers in our society for mobility?
We have, because to go to college, you not only need to take all the right courses, you need to apply in a certain amount of time, you have to get letters of recommendation, and then if you start college, it's a very complicated system. You have to test in the right classes, et cetera, and it's not always transparent or clear. The City University of New York has just done a reform so that if somebody completes a class in a community college, it will transfer to a four-year college, but up until now, that system wasn't in place. So even negotiating transfers is quite difficult in many institutions.
But is it also true with these middle-class families, and perhaps because they had their experience with college, but that they were negotiating with their children's schools, you know, and sort of managing their education from perhaps pre-K?
Absolutely. And so in high school, a white middle-class mother, calculus, AP calculus and AP English was at the same time. She went to the school and said, look, you've got to get this worked out. People help people transfer out of a class. People help with if they were going to get a C in chemistry. They said, was there any extra work they could do? So parents were always overseeing. So often it was a 2 or 3 person student career with both the mother and the father helping the child in a very intensive way when the young people were in high school.
So the style that you saw in the more working class and poor families, which was giving kids a lot of freedom to sort of raise themselves or do their own thing, didn't work so well, I guess, when applied to college.
That's right, because you could imagine a school system that's more lockstep. There's other programs, for example, somebody studied nursing programs in Chicago. And once you entered, it's a non-negotiable system. Everybody takes the same classes. So you could certainly design institutions so that they're more helpful for students from a range of backgrounds. But as long as we have a system where you have to choose the classes and match it, make sure, then a lot of responsibility gets put on the family to make sure that you're in compliance with these very complicated college applications.
We've done I've sort of lost count of the numbers of shows that we've done about education, and one of the complaints that you hear from teachers, especially in some of the poorer neighborhoods, is that, you know, where are the parents? I mean, the parents don't come to school. I don't feel like the parents and I are on the same team. Do you understand that complaint?
Well, it's a hard job to be a teacher, and
it
teachers
is.
Play a very important role in our society. And yet the reality is that many of those parents are respecting the teacher. The parents are high school dropouts. For example, if I had to have brain surgery, I wouldn't be going into the surgeon saying, I really think you ought to do this strategy when you do a surgery in my brain. I would depend on the brain surgeon to do it. So, too, these parents are depending on the teachers to educate them, their children. And they believe the teachers have special expertise, which they lack.
Hmm.
So there's a way in which they respect the professional expertise of the teacher by not supervising them in a way middle-class parents don't, who often can be rude and demanding with teachers. But that difference often isn't noticed by teachers because they're yearning for much more support.
Sure, a more collaborative relationship with a parent, I guess.
They are. They do say they want partners, but really I think teachers want praise. They really don't want criticism and they don't want intervention. They want parents to do what they say and they want parents to praise them. So teachers like parents who praise them.
Oh, I mean, don't we all?
That's right.
Just to follow up on that, let me also just do a follow-up question, then I do want to get to our callers here. What's interesting is when you caught up with these families 10 years hence, and now I guess 20 years hence, I don't think I have my numbers exactly right, but nonetheless, when you caught up with them, some of them were pretty angry at you. They felt like you had really misrepresented their family life.
Yes, it's a very intimate portrait of family life. Each family is an entire chapter. And of course, their real names aren't used. And what they, but many of them had their feelings hurt by it. Mm-hmm. And when I did the study, I suspected that would happen. I said, oh, you're not going to like it. It's kind of like when somebody takes a picture of you and you think other people think it's fine, but you don't like it. But things that they felt, the working class families were insistent they had been very energetically involved in children's schooling, and so they took umbrage at the idea that they hadn't been supervising their children's schooling in a way that they felt was very intense. Some of the working class parents objected to being in the same sentence with poor families because they felt their lives were so different than poor families. And then some of the families just felt that they, for example, one of the white middle class families felt that I suggested they had favored a child and they had very strong views of treating children equally, and so they were offended by that.
And so does it matter who's right under those circumstances?
I think that the reality is when you do research, there are drawbacks to research. And when people do research on medicine, sometimes, occasionally, rarely, people die from it. And so research is never cost-free.
Yeah.
You know, I believe we learn important and valuable things from research. And I think it's if we understand that there are class differences in childbearing, then we can maybe design institutions to be more responsive and effective. But there can be challenges as well.
And one of the quotes I saw someone saying to you, you slurred us. You made us look like poor white trash.
They did.
Does that hurt?
as in any stressful situation, you lose sleep and you do some soul searching about this. What was interesting was it was a play within a play, because in the upper middle class family said it wasn't professionally done. I thought it would have shown more maturity.
Oh, this was a criticism of
me.
Of you.
While the white working class family said, you made us, you slurred us, you made us look like poor white trash. So they had the same criticism, but the way they framed it was also different. So it was a play within a play how they treated us.
And perhaps makes sense as you understand the kind of research you were doing? Anticipating that kind of reaction.
I guess. I mean, the middle class parents had gone to college and they understood what college was, while the view of it, higher education was a little bit more blurry, I think. The difference between a GED, which is a degree you get from when you complete high school, and a BA was really unclear to many of the working class families. They were both diplomas. They were both graduating. Mm-hmm. And so who I was and what the book would be was different. But I think in retrospect that the working class families thought it was going to be like wedding photography. It was going to be a very beautiful, glowing picture of their family moments. And so when it was a more analytical process. And, you know, I would be in a study. I would be happy to be in a study, but I'm sure it would hurt my feelings what somebody wrote. So sure. I think in some ways this is the cost of doing business.
And that's Annette LaRoe. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, president of the American Sociological Association. And for a number of years now, she's been looking at families, this issue of class, even race. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family Life. And she's currently working on how families decide where to live and where to send their children to school. I do want to talk about that as well. But let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. In fact, we have an email from Sage. Why weren't upper class families examined? Did you think about that, Annette?
I did. You have to make hard choices in doing this kind of research, because if you one visit, we would visit 2 or 3 hours, and we would write field notes for 5 to 12 hours from every visit. So you had to make hard choices.
Right.
I think that upper class families, I think there's some research that they're very similar to upper middle class families in how they raise their children, but they face special challenges because of the, if you're extremely wealthy, then there are special worries that parents have about that.
I mean, just the worries of the effect of too much money?
That, and also the children can be subject to ridicule and to criticism because they're from a rich family. And that can also, there can be peer effects as well.
Let me get, looks like Alita from Pottstown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Alita. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had said that I had kind of a two-part question. One being in the sample, and I realize it was a very small sample. I know you started looking at 19 families and ended up with 12. If you interviewed more than that, and whether or not you tried to weed out or whether these were included, families that involved alcohol abuse, drug abuse, those sort of dynamics, where if you try to weed those out so that you have a better, similar sample. And then the second part of my question is, are you planning to continue following these now 30-year-olds into their adult life? Because I feel like my relationship, for instance, with my siblings has changed drastically over the years. My brother and I, who were only a year apart, fought like cats and dogs. I mean, fought. And now we're very close, and our children are very close. And so I also feel like I'm a little different in the mix, where I had a mother who attended college. I had a father who was more working class. And although they split, I don't know. So maybe my upbringing is different. I did grow up with alcohol and drug abuse, and yet none of my siblings abused any of it. And so maybe it was because we had a strong mother. I'm not sure. But I'll take my answer off the air.
Alita, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Did you weed out or have to deal with drugs and alcohol?
We did not weed out. We chose the children mostly from the classrooms, and so then we dealt with whatever they had. We had 88 families where we had interviews, and we did have alcohol and drug use. At least it was clear in some of the families, though not all. For a while, I thought about doing a follow-up study where I went out and tried to find upper middle class families who were facing life challenges through alcohol and drug abuse. But really, the focus was on child rearing. I mean, most of the research shows it's really the mother's education, which is key. Mothers spend more time with children in general. If they're a divorce or single parent, usually it's mothers who have custody. And so mothers play a very powerful role in shaping. And we know that mother's education is one of the best predictors in huge national studies of children's SAT scores or how much education children go on to get.
And these children are now in their 30s or a 30. Will you continue to do that?
Well, you know, there's a famous movie called 7
Up. I just scribbled that down.
46
yes.
Up. And he lost a number of people as he went because they got their feelings hurt. And so now the sample is quite small. And so I had 12, but there are some families who don't want to be in touch with me anymore. And I would rather have a whole sample. And also I'm doing a new study. I did a study of how parents decide where to live. And it was interesting because given how assiduous these middle-class parents are over every little thing, that what gymnastics program, when we ask parents how they decide where to live, people just asked around and talked to their friends, and then they moved to a suburban community that they said was a good community. And so there was a sort of sleepwalking into school districts, which was very striking. It was striking in a contrast with how people select colleges or how they select kids' activities, and on a very important life decision. So we have this edited book, Choosing Homes, Choosing Schools, where this parent's scrutiny is not in all fields. And they would just ask their friends, and their friends and neighbors said, oh, this is a good school district, and they would move there. But they really wouldn't do much research, even people who had PhDs.
Well, that's interesting. And there is a trend. In fact, we did a show not so long ago about middle-class families in Philadelphia deciding, do you send your child to a school in Philadelphia or do you choose the suburbs? And I guess the suburbs standing in for all the districts that surround this particular city.
That's right. And people would choose houses. Even people who were pregnant or people who had little kids didn't really think about school when they bought their house. But then a few years later, they thought about school. So families in on the city in our study, they were extremely worried about where to send their children to school. But the housing decision was separate than the school decision. And once they had a school-aged child, they did a lot of work to find a school that they thought would be appropriate.
What does that tell us? I mean, as you said, it's so here are these parents that micromanage almost every part of their life, but not particularly this part.
Well, we live in a society that is stratified. That people, we know that economic stratification has increased. So people in McMansions tend to live together. People in poor neighborhoods tend to live together. And that separation has increased over recent decades. We live in more fragmented than we used to. So people talk to people like them, and they say this is a good neighborhood, and they go there, and they can be comfortable often that they will have people of a similar class and race in that neighborhood.
I mean, can we call that self-segregation, or it's just sort of that's the end result?
That is the end result, and children end up in very different schools, and then there's research showing that what neighborhood you are in does have an independent effect on children's outcomes. So neighborhood segregation is a very important public policy, and yet these decisions were done very rapidly. And then once people chose a school district, then they started looking systematically at houses. But the more important decision about where they're going to go is something they made really often a matter of hours.
Interesting. We're almost up in a break here. And I think there are parents who are really very careful about this project, this decision as well.
We did. We did find some parents who did test scores and research, but they were unusual. And most parents just ask their friends or their relatives where they should live.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about families. We're talking about school, class, child rearing. And again, Annette LaRoe, our guest. She's a professor of social sciences and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. This is her area of inquiry, of research. And we're taking a very short break. We've got a lot of callers that want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
People's Light and Theater presents Dear Elizabeth, a lyrical, intimate, and moving portrait of two acclaimed American poets, Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell, played by Rindy Eckert and Ellen McLaughlin. Using her trademark intelligence and whimsy, playwright Sarah Rule breathes life into a relationship that delicately adapts Bishop and Lowell's 30-year correspondence into living poetry on stage. For tickets, peopleslight.org or 610-644-3500. People's Light supports WHYY.
Little kids giving us the business. I like to start like duct tape businesses, so like you can make stuff out of duct tape, like you can make purses out of duct tape.
A six-year-old and her startup plans from a program that encourages young girls to hold on to their big ideas. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Chestnut Hill. St. Paul's announces its celebration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ to the community on Saturday, April 19th. A candlelight vigil will be held at 7:30 p.m. with the choir. On Easter morning, the full choir and congregation will celebrate with festal Eucharists at 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. Holy Week and Easter services at St. Paul's are open to the public. Located at 22 East Chestnut Hill Avenue, close to SEPTA. Details at stpaulschestnuthill.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with sociologist Annette Leroux. We're talking about her field of research, which is how does class affect a child's achievement in school and in life? We've got a lot of callers, and I do want to get to them. We also have a tweet from Molly. What happens when grown children who are raised in different socioeconomic conditions become parents themselves? Have you looked at that, Annette?
There's research that suggests parents mostly parent, they parent as they were parented, but also when people are upwardly mobile, they change their parenting. So there's something about college which is transformative to parenting. And so people whose parents, they grew up with a lot of corporal punishment, a lot of directives, they go to college, they get a college degree, and they're much more likely to use reasoning timeouts with their children. And so as children have exposure to college, they change their strategies.
Did you find differences between boys and girls or men and women?
As the children became young adults, as a lot of research would have suggested, the role of race grew, and the young black men certainly reported being followed around in stores or being seen as being criminals. Even, you know, a young black man who went to Ivy League school, had very high SAT scores, was in pre-med program, had problems with people, you know, coming and putting things away in the store if he was in the back corner. But all of the white working class men and poor men complained bitterly about the police and the harassment by the police and police being crooked and difficult. So it was really the white middle class men, a man who really was spared that indignity. But it was the complaints weren't simply from the blacks. They were also from the white working class and poor young men.
And how about the girls or the women?
The girls were less vocal about those issues, and nationally we know that girls, especially African-American girls, often do better in school than African-American boys. But that trend is certainly happening in terms of college enrollment and college graduation.
Let me get Carol from Kutztown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
This is really great. Thank you so much for this conversation. I grew up in a suburb. So I was pretty suspect about raising my kids in a suburb because I had criticism. And I had read James Kunstler's book, The Geography of Nowhere, and one of the things he talked about is kids finding their way home. So the idea of home was sort of an overriding thing, even maybe more than school for us. And I'm wondering about location of home, what you found about that, because one of my coworkers told me that living in a suburb was interesting because people were so transient that they actually had to turn to each other more. So there was sort of more cohesion, but at the same time, lots of difference in terms of class. And in terms, not a class because they could all afford to live there, but in terms of ethnicity, religion, etc. So I'm wondering how the idea of where home is and what role that plays in your research.
Carol, thanks for the call to Radio Times. It's an interesting question. What home means?
Yes. It depended on many sort of quirks of fate, but the houses were bigger in the suburbs and the birth rate was lower. And so in some of the middle class kids, there were actually kids outside on the street playing hockey and playing sports. But that was not generally the case in the suburban homes. Generally, there was nobody on the street. And there simply weren't enough warm bodies for kids to go around and put together a group of kids to do a pickup game. And so organized activities became the way that kids socialized, which were always mediated by adults. And there's an interesting article article in The Atlantic called The Overprotected Child, which describes the idea of children being away from adults, being lost, being scared, which they suggest are very good for kids developmentally, are very rare, especially for middle-class kids. They're always being watched. They're always being scrutinized by their parents, and that was also consistent with our observations.
Would you agree with that it is important for children to find their way home or have to deal with some kind of an incident without parental intervention or involvement?
I think the research is very compelling on that, and that as sometimes we try to protect our children or overprotect our children, we prevent them from having experiences that are developmentally healthy. Mm-hmm. So it's good for children to get lost, to be afraid. That's what the Grimm's fairy tales, horrible things happen in them, but there's a way for children to try out these demons and then in many ways shrink them. And that if we're always trying to protect children and playing in the backyard and never being out of sight from the adults, then children don't have that kind of exposure, which our working class kids did have in my study.
I'm curious about your childhood. I mean, I'm a boomer, and I remember on Saturdays basically we lived in the country, but kind of being tossed out of the house and come home 10 hours later, you know, and no one knew what we were doing.
Absolutely. And children did reckless things. They jumped off buildings. They dropped off to you. They got, you know, and sometimes they would be hurt by that, but not that often, really. And there were many people I interviewed, the adults of this study, where their parents would lock the door and they say, "You're coming back at 5 o'clock. You're coming back at lunch." It would be inconceivable today to send an 8-year-old out for 8 hours and say, "Don't come back unless you really need something."
How about for you growing up?
That was the same thing. I was one of 4 children. And
were you locked out?
We were not locked out, but we were expected to keep ourselves busy, and we were expected, we played on the street and wandered around, and I remember sometimes things were scary. Yep. We got lost and this and that, but on the other hand, I do think there were benefits to that.
Let me get Jim from Willingboro to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead. You're on the air, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're
real
welcome.
Quick, does the study take a look at the level of self-education that parents trying to push education and learning on the children, but are there parents who are trying to also teach themselves things that are going on?
Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Not exactly sure what that noise was, but the idea, I guess, of parents educating themselves or maybe taking classes or exploring things for their own education. Did you see that?
Yeah, we saw the middle-class parents were more likely to read the newspaper and read things online, read novels. And reading is very important for children, especially to see their parents read. And that's, I think, one of the research that over and over again shows benefits for parents. If parents want to help their children in school with little kids reading to them and then reading themselves is also very positive. And we did see middle-class parents being more likely to engage in that kind of reading. Mm.
And was it just the other parent, they were just too busy or they didn't have time or just wasn't on their radar?
It was a combination of factors. And of course, 15% of the country is functionally illiterate. And so their actual reading skills were quite uneven among the working class parents. And that's the other concern. A lot of teachers want parents to read to kids. But I think they don't always realize that the parents' reading skills are often very minimal. Mm-hmm. And parents don't want to be embarrassed in front of their children. They don't want to be corrected by their children. So I think parent involvement programs that seek to involve cousins or aunts or uncles are often more effective than ones that involve parents because parents' own literacy skills can be quite limited.
Jim, thanks for the call. Let's see what Maria from Reading has to say. Hi, Maria. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My question is the impact that technology might have had on the study that you did. I'm thinking that maybe the working class parents didn't have experience with computers and access to technology, and during your study time, a lot of applications to colleges and that sort of thing were via the Internet. Just wondering about that.
Sure. Thanks, Maria. Go ahead.
Well, I think other research does show a digital divide. And in this more recent study I did about how parents went about choosing schools, it was interesting. All the working class parents had access to computers. Sometimes it was in the library. Sometimes it was their aunt's or father's house. But they all had it. But they tended not to use it to look up, say, school statistics. But, of course, the upper middle class parents didn't do it either. Mm-hmm. People who had PhDs didn't look up the school statistics. And so we're doing all this work to create test measures in schools, but then people are really using informal networks to get informal knowledge is face-to-face recommendations, word of mouth remain very powerful in many aspects of daily life.
There's this focus now on what's been called grit or you know, kind of a stick-to-itiveness. That's the idea of individual effort will pay off. If you just work harder, you will succeed. I mean, such an American idea there. Does that make sense to you as someone who has looked at families in class and how families operate?
Well, I think children do have different temperaments. And you see even early on, some kids are a little bit more resilient, some kids are more fragile, some children have more determination. But I think we also have to look at social resources. I mean, if you go to a hospital in a poor neighborhood or a rich neighborhood, then hospitals aren't that different. But schools are extremely different. So if we could just make our schools about as similar as our hospitals were, that would be a huge improvement. And so I think we have to look at the resources that are going to schools, the programs for food stamps and other social support. We know poverty is bad for children. It's just undeniable that it's bad for children, and yet 40% of our children are either poor or near poor. And so we have a situation where we have many poor children in America being raised with food shortages and other difficulty. And I don't think we can completely close the gap, but we could certainly narrow the gap. But the answer to that, I think, is not grit. It's more social support.
It's interesting. I mean, not so long ago, or maybe a generation or two ago, it was the elderly poor. I mean, huge numbers of people would get old and they would become poor. Can we do for children what we've done for older people?
We certainly could. I mean, the great majority of Americans were poor. Older Americans were poor in the 20s and the 30s, something around three quarters. And now that number has just plummeted. And it plummeted because of a federal Social Security program. And so we could certainly do that for poor children to provide more income support, say, for example, compared to the Scandinavian or Germany or France. And the U.S. has a very high rate of infant mortality, and we have very high rates of child poverty. So we think of ourselves as the leader of the world, but really we have very high rates of poverty compared to other comparable countries.
So the idea of some kind of a stipend, I mean, to give to all families?
Mm-hmm. When children are born, that there be a stipend. Also, if we reduce the cost of daycare, our daughter lives in Spain. They're starting daycare, and the daycare is about $200 a month, which is a fraction of what it is here. So you would need more state support for both food and for health care and for child care.
Let me get Renee from Northeast Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Renee. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I wonder what the opinion is on children that sort of they sort of have experience in both classes. We are, by every means, we are a working class family. However, I definitely identify my parenting style with the middle class, and our children have always attended private college preparatory schools. Our daughter has graduated from University of Pennsylvania. She studied abroad at Oxford. She's now a young adult, and my son is, you know, shortly behind her. I think it's been extremely good for them to have these experiences, and I always wanted them to have the best that I could provide, whether it was by scholarship or working, you know, extra jobs. But I also see them struggle a bit with not acceptance. They've been accepted, you know, wonderfully. They have wonderful friends. They go on wonderfully fabulous vacations. But I think they struggle a little bit, like, you know, this is still home. At the end of the day, they still come home to a very, very different house and different family.
And living in two worlds. Renee, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Annette, what do you think?
Yes,
thanks, Renee. Rather.
These interviews I did with Heather Curl and Tina Wu with these people who are upwardly mobile, they described really living in two worlds. And so they went to college, and it was very bewildering to go to college, and people seemed to know things that they didn't know. There were big words that people used. And they noticed that their taste changed as well, like their parents might drink Bud or, you know, and then they would want, like, these microbreweries. Mm-hmm. And then they would go home, and people would accuse them of being stuck up. And yet they would be with their friends, and they would notice that some of the people weren't that nice to the waiters, or they would treat people who could have been their brother. So they had this sort of they had special insight into both, but they also felt uncomfortable, for example, if their parents used they're wrong, you know, and their grammar and their big word. And so they and their parents then sometimes would accuse them of being stuck up, and that would be difficult too.
Yeah, tricky worlds to navigate.
That's right.
Renee, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you think, and what's interesting about your research, and you do not judge these families. I mean, you're saying these are families who care about their children. They just go about it differently. But do you find that the people are overly judgmental? The parents are overly judgmental of other parents, if I can put it that
way.
That's
right. Well, at the time I did the study, I didn't have children. I since got married and have children by marriage. And it was actually a good thing because parents feel very deeply about how they raise their children. And I wanted to be more neutral and to see May a Thousand Flowers Bloom. And I think you have to remember that if we raised children the way we raised children in colonial America, people would be arrested. I mean, people saw children as not being innocent, as having evil spirits, of needing to be beat, of being treated very harshly in ways that have completely gone out of fashion. So we have to see child rearing like fashions and clothes and makeup, that they change regularly. And in my view, I think there's not one right way to raise children, but there are certainly more drawbacks to middle-class child rearing than are often realized and talked about in daily life.
And the drawbacks meaning just this sort of hyperkinetic lifestyle of nonstop nurturance.
That's right.
And development.
That's right. I think, people are tired. Middle-class parents, extremely tiring to talk to children all the time. People are busy. There's not much downtime. And then also there's a great emphasis on individualism, which necessarily the group. So, for example, I talked to somebody in a different context, and he didn't go to his first cousin's wedding. It was kind of inconvenient. He wasn't that close to her. And his mother wanted him to go, but he didn't feel like it wasn't his preference. So I think as you cultivate kids' individual preferences, then it can challenge the notions of group and public space and group cohesion and also group obligations for one another.
And it sounds like, and we're almost out of time here, but for the more working class family, the groups seem to matter a lot.
They matter a lot.
Family.
It's hard to overestimate the importance of family and working class families. And family, everyone thinks family is important. At the end of people's lives, people talk about family compared to work. And there's a way in which you belong. It might be boring, deadening, and frustrating with your cousins and your aunts, but you are a member of a group. And there's more isolation and individual and loneliness sometimes, I think, in these upper middle class families.
Well, we could go on. We do have to end the hour. And Annette Leroux, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. And she's the Stanley I. Scheer Professor of Social Sciences and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. And we've been talking about her research, which she wrote in a book called Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family Life. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, archives, podcasts, satellite radio, and email. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant, and help today from Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.